jazz is not dead. It just sucks.
Hello, you're listening to the podcast version of Deutsche Vlog, a series of interviews, conversations with scholars in the field of media studies. My name is Mark Deutsche, and I'm your host. And the music you're listening to is my band, Skinflower. Hello, welcome to another episode of my series of interviews and conversations with inspiring professionals and academics from the field of media studies and the media industry. And today I'm joined by two colleagues from the Netherlands, both working all over the world, that have a unique position in having a sort of a purview of the entire media industry, speaking to people and talent across multiple disciplines and fields. And so we're going to be talking a lot about what they see happening in the industry, what the current debates and discussions are, and what has changed in the two or three decades that they've been involved in all of these industries. My guests are Monique van Düsseldorp and Taco Reisemus. Monique is an event organizer, curator, moderator. She's been doing this for decades, organizing and curating events about the new media industry and the media industry and IT industry all over the world. At the moment, for example, she works for the What's Next conference, highlighting new ideas, exciting new ideas in the realm of media, innovation, and technology. She hosts and moderates the regular Cross Media Cafe online sessions for the Dutch media industry, where people from different parts of the industry come and present sort of cutting-edge new ideas and technologies. Dutch Digital Day, the Tweakers Developer Summit, works for Emerce and for all kinds of other organizations. She also contributes to influential industry newsletter, her own newsletter, Future of Events, and this New World Same Humans newsletter. She's been in the events business since the 1990s, when she founded her own company, Van Düsseldorp, in 1998. Taco Reisemus is currently the CEO of the All3 Media company in Germany, part of the global All3 Media group, co-owned by Discovery and Liberty. Before that, he was the CEO of a production and marketing agency, IDTV. And before that, he was the managing director at Dutch public broadcaster KRO-NCRV and managing director of commercial broadcasting organization SBS. And amidst all of these roles, and he got his start as a correspondent for a regional broadcaster in the Netherlands way back in the day, in between all of these leadership roles, he also managed in 2014 to get his PhD on a dissertation on the possibility, or I should say impossibility, of objectivity in journalism. With Taco and Monique, I'm talking about issues that affect people across the industry, the special role that talent has in the industry, and the equally significant role data has in the industry, the definition of being creative and creativity, and how to handle and how to manage creativity throughout your career, and how to prepare for what comes next, are at the heart of our interview today. So sit back, enjoy, and please subscribe and leave a comment and engage in discussion. Always love to hear from you. All right. Well, welcome, Taco. Welcome, Monique. Very good to see you. Very good to have you here with us today. I would like for us to talk a little bit about your perspectives on the media. I mean, of course, the media encapsulates so many different types of industries, so many different kinds of media, different ways of telling stories, of producing news and entertainment and information, all. And you are both in different ways in somewhat of a unique position of sort of, whether you like it or not, kind of people come to you for perspectives on all of this and for decisions on all of this and to curate these kind of things. And I know both of you as being very excited about the possibilities of all of this. So I want to tap into to that a little bit for our conversation today. And I guess maybe we can just start at the beginning, at how you got started in your careers. I mean, both of you are now in different ways, like I said, in leadership positions, but you got started in very different ways. Taco, you were a correspondent for a regional broadcaster. Monique, I mean, fairly early on in your career, you set up your own company that's still up and running today. Both of you have been sort of, but you're still very much your own entrepreneur, right? I mean, and I think that's a really interesting position to have in this industry as well. So I guess after doing this now for 20, 25 years or so, and you look back, I mean, how would you make sense of your career? And I'm asking this also because so many people, when they think about, I want to work in the media, or this is how the media works, perhaps do not appreciate as much that a lot of work in the media and careers in the media are entirely unpredictable. And so a lot of people that I've interviewed, senior people, and they look back and they say, nothing really made sense. It just seemed like a good idea at the time. Now, I think that's a bit too easy. I mean, certainly there was a plan, there was a strategy, but I wonder if you look back now, what was your plan? What was your strategy and how did it pan out? Monique, may I ask you to kick us off?
Okay, well, in my case, there was certainly no plan. If I think back to the time that I went to art school. And then because after a while, I realized that maybe that was not the only thing I wanted to do. And I actually graduated in fine arts with lithographs and etchings and, really undigital work. And I realized I wanted to do something different. So I also studied language and literature, which is, those two combined, you cannot do anything else but work in the media because both didn't lead to any career path. And what happened was the only thing at the time was that I wanted to go abroad. That was my plan. I want to leave Tilburg. This is my city. I had been living there until I was 25. I had never been on a plane even. So I had a very, small life. And I ended up doing an internship at the European Institute for the Media. And that's where it started. I had been to Boston. I studied in Boston first. But my plan was, how do I get away? And that was do an exchange program in Boston and then live in the UK and Germany for 5 years. So that's how it started. And the wish to be somewhere else was bigger than the wish for what exactly I was going to do at the time. Of course, then I got lucky. The internet started, but that's the second story. The first story is I need to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. I need to go and see a different world. Yeah.
And the second story, you credit the internet for this. We're talking, I guess, late
1990s. I ended up at the European Institute for the Media, which was in Manchester at the time. My humble task was organize the move from Manchester to Düsseldorf, counter computers, I had specifically said that I hadn't done German in high school, which I hadn't. But nevertheless, as a Dutch person, I was seen as the interface to everybody in Germany. So my task was to call people and organize this thing. This was the project. And then when I was there, there was a European Television and Film Forum, which was held in Seville. So lucky me, I ended up in a role that put me in different countries all the time in Seville. And the person that ran it fell ill and I stepped in. I happened to just do a good job at it. So it was completely coincidental that I ended up in events. Of course, looking back, it wasn't, because my character and my way of working fit that career. That's what I realized in the end. But at the time, I didn't know that I ended up there and you know, just, and I loved working. I really loved working. So I worked all the time. And the internet was the thing that happened. I worked at the European Institute for Media. They had a library in which the electronic media department was television. I mean, they lived in a newspaper age and television was a new thing. So it was a very old fashioned institute. And then, because the internet had been happening for a while, but I finally convinced the director at the time that I could get an email address. So I got, this is what I got, eh? Monique@compuserve.com. They didn't even allow me to do the real internet. And I just felt this is something so exciting and it's so interesting. And I had no idea why and how and what, but that was the thing that I realized you know, doesn't matter what role, this is something that I want to be part of. I want to be part of this new wave that's going to happen. And that's what happened afterwards.
Taco, how was this for you? I mean, there's a combination in Monique's story of serendipity as well as personality. Is that similar in your origin story?
Well, actually, I was thinking of what Monique said, of being a part of something. And which I think that's something I felt very strongly as well. I remember the first time when I have worked all my life in television. And I remember the day I was, you know, I got this, there was this sparkle and I was actually in university. I got there was a course, audiovisual communication. And they made a breakdown of a documentary or something. I don't know exactly. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. And I knew at that moment that I wanted to work the rest of my life on television, audiovisual storytelling. That's what I wanted to do. And so we are of the same generation, I think. Maybe Monique is a bit younger, but at the time it was very, very complicated to get a job in television. So all my friends, they became IT consultants. That was the thing that you did when you couldn't get a job. And I remember that, you know, I just didn't give up. I said, I'm not going to be an IT consultant. I applied for the lowest of the lowest in television. That was Call TV. For the people who don't know what Call TV is, that you could call in. And there was just only a presenter. And that was it. But I didn't even get that job. So I was, so then I finally, with the help of the employment agency, I could do a practical course, you know, and that's how I got my first job, actually. So persistence is something that that was a part of my career path. But on the other hand, it has been for me also very unpredictable. I have been. It's more that I'm curious. I'm quickly fascinated by new things, and I have personal development is very important for me. So I like to learn new things, and maybe it will be a bit long to describe my whole career. But currently, my last step was from being a CEO of IDTV to becoming a CEO of a group where I'm mainly working in Germany now. So I'm sitting now in an office in Berlin. And so I'm still doing what I love. I'm working for television, but I'm doing it in another market, in another culture, with people I don't know, and I love it. Mm. So I'm challenged in every way you can imagine. It's great. And also the knowledge, I underestimated that actually a bit. The knowledge that you have built up over the years is, of course, also, you can use it also in another market, in another country, etc. But how I got here was totally, well, it's more unpredictable. I was, I ended up working for public broadcasting, because they needed someone, a media director, and this person had to be a Catholic, and they couldn't find anyone. And it turned out that my background is, I come from a Catholic family, so they hired me. How accidental can it be?
Yeah. But at least you knew what you wanted to do. You wanted to be in television. You had a goal. Because if Mark, now I'm taking over as a moderator, which I shouldn't, but
I now wonder maybe, where that expertise comes from, Monique. But I said sure.
But let's put it different. There are different paths to get somewhere. I mean, Taco, by all means, is a super successful guy running big companies, having a fantastic career in television. I'm a freelancer. You know, I have these days a tiny little office at an industry park in Diemen-Noord, and I sit behind my computer and every so often go out there, and I don't have a pension and this and that. So it's a completely different route, but I'm really fine where I am. So I think your students also need to know, you know, that it's, you have to find a path where you feel like, oh, I'm really happy to be here. And it doesn't have to be, you know, to be the CEO of a huge media company. It can also be something else. And in this case, it matches my, I think you have to love the process. That's it as well. I mean, in the end, what I do these days is putting together conference programs about new developments, but it forces me to read and figure out and call people. And this is this the process of it I like really a lot. Whereas at the time when I was the student, I literally, when I graduated, I got a little grant for my artwork, and I had to decide, shall I buy a lithographic press or a PC? And this, you know, I couldn't sleep for weeks. You know, it was just, I had no idea what to do with my life. I had no plans. I didn't know where to go. And nevertheless, in the end, you can find something by just, you know, going out there.
I do want to return a little bit to both your stories, because I mean, I appreciate the unpredictability and that you couldn't predict from the start that you end up as a CEO or end up as putting these amazing, amazing international events together. And there is an element of randomness and all that, I'm sure of that. On the other hand, what I'm also hearing, but maybe I'm projecting too much, is that both of you, almost despite of yourself, kind of knew what you wanted and stuck with it. I mean, Taki, you're telling us about your friends that, you know, didn't get a job and ended up doing IT consulting, because at least you can always get work there. But you decided against that and sort of stuck with it, even going as far as going to an employment agency in order to keep on pursuing whatever you wanted to do. And Monique, yeah, you may not have known exactly that this is what you wanted, but you, like you said, you were committed to whatever I do, it has to be international.
Yep.
Whatever I do, it has to be, you know, exciting, meeting new people.
It has to be interesting because I'm easily bored.
Right. Yes. So there is a core element of knowing what you want in there. And it might not be knowing what you want as in this job title, this job description, this set of competences, but knowing what you want is almost like knowing yourself. Like, you know, what makes me happy.
Yeah, but I didn't at the time. I honestly had panic attacks when I was thinking about my life, because I had no clue. I just want to tell this to reassure some of your students that actually in
it's
life,
okay.
Yeah, this happens and it also can disappear again. But I had no idea at all. But then, you know, if you are as lucky to be able to do that, then you go with what is interesting. You know, right. Go for what's interesting. And also, it's really strange to see, you know, I have teenage kids now, so I'm looking at them and figuring out what they're going to do, trying not to meddle. it can simply be that you're attracted to a certain crowd, certain type of people, you know, people that type, you know, it's sometimes it only matters that you go somewhere and then you'll figure out what your role is in that bigger area that you want to be in. You don't know that beforehand what you're going to do.
Taco, how is that for you? Knowing what you want?
There are different thoughts going through my head. One of the thoughts is we kind of underestimate. We think ourselves through time as the same person. But of course, I'm now 52 years old. I'm not the same person as I was when I first was in this college, in this room, hearing from listening and seeing television for the first time. So that's completely different. It is, for me personally, people always say, yeah, but you're a very ambitious guy, and that's why you ended up being the CEO of a company. And I had a tendency to say, no, I'm not ambitious at all. And to to come to the conclusion that I'm actually a very ambitious person. But this ambition is not that we generally think of as ambition, because when we talk about ambition, you just think, oh, you want to be CEO of a company and earn a lot of money. But my ambition has always been to learn, to develop, to new things. And I always have been very passionate about it. And when Monique said, yeah, I found something and I was perfectly happy with it. I have done many, many jobs before I got this job, and I was always very happy doing it. I was always very passionate about it. And for some reason, sooner or later, someone came by and said, don't you want to do this as well? How would you feel like doing that? And so that's actually my personal ambition, you understand? So it's something else that would we generally see as ambition. It's not, I have never ever had in my mind, and my friends always still make jokes about it. Everybody thought after college that I would end up, you know, being a very poor journalist looking for a freelance job somewhere. And the fact that of my fraternity, I'm, well, what's now in society then considered to be very successful, it's been surprising for every one of them. But it has never been my goal, if you get what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And it still isn't. So I'm so also now I'm really, really enjoying what I'm doing.
I want to follow up on that, because we've started talking about how you got started, both of you. But now let's talk about the future, because I mean, the media industry is an incredibly fast moving thing. And both of you are telling us something about this sort of both your personality as well as a sort of a necessary competence that you need to have, which is to constantly be curious and to stay curious about what's going to happen next. Ooh, that's exciting. And I'm wondering, especially because you're now in a much more senior or leadership role than you were perhaps in the past, and you're curating events or you're making executive decisions. I mean, I guess what I'm wondering is how do you still get excited about something new? How do you notice when people pitch you ideas or somebody tells a story at in an event that you're moderating, you go like, yeah, I've been there, done that, seen that before. So on the one hand, I'm wondering, how do you keep your feet on the ground in the context of an industry that's constantly changing and there's constantly things that are new, or at least people that claiming that things are new? And on the other hand, how do you stay that, I mean, I'm almost tempted to say that kid that's sort of like, oh, this is great, this is exciting, I want to find out more. I mean, there is a sort of a nerdy, childlike kind of enthusiasm there that I'm sensing and that I've picked up from all these interviews as well. But there's a balancing act between those two. And I wonder how that makes sense to you. How do you keep your feet on the ground and still be excited about something new? How do you do that?
Wow. So I go first?
Or you yeah, please do. Please do. Yeah.
Actually, it's one of the, it's very interesting that you mention it, because you already, you warned us that you would have this question, and I get caught. And it's actually quite hard, I have to say. Mm. And because also many of the developments that you mention, for instance, the use of data. Mm-hmm. I find it very interesting, the use of data. So 10 years ago, I think then this hype came up, everything would be data. Also creativity, yeah, well, at least based on solid data. And so also it was at a time, and was it 6 years ago that Netflix came up and they had these great algorithms and you would find everything through data. And so what I have learned to do is to follow my own instinct as a user. Mm. So I find the algorithm that Netflix has complete shit. Mm. I've never had a good tip in my, what I get is never is my taste, to be honest. Mm. And so I started to many of these developments to look at them with a critical eye also, you know, and not to, so to on the one hand, you're excited, so how interesting that is all possible. And on the other hand, to also have a critical view on things from the position as a consumer or a user or a viewer or whatever you want to call it. And that's a thin line. It's not always easy to keep the balance, I have to admit. Sometimes I also lost myself in new trends and opportunities. But on the other hand, if you look at what I'm doing, where I'm responsible for, that is storytelling, audiovisual storytelling in the media, it has been remarkably stable, I have to say. If you look at storytelling on television, film, of course, there are changes. Of course, you have new trends, etc. But on the the basis is really very stable, despite all the new developments that have been there. That would be my long answer to a short question, Mark.
I appreciate it, Taco. I mean, Monique, how is there, do you recognize this sentiment or this way of balancing, or how do you do it?
Well, I guess there's two ways about it. If you look at me as a person or you look at me as a career, I mean, career-wise, every 2 or 3 years, honestly, and I've been doing exactly the same work forever. I spot some trends, I read about them, I call people, I put together conference programs, sometimes I moderate them, sometimes I write about them, but that's it. I mean, it's the same thing. And every 2 or 3 years, I get completely bored. Honestly, I think another conference, I can't stand it anymore. I'm done. I'm going to do something else with my life. And then 2 months later, I realize I have no second plan and I have no other skills, basically. And something happens and I'm excited and interested again. And I think wait a minute, there's somebody doing something so interesting over there and nobody sees it. I have to put them on a stage. So in the end, I realized my role is not organizing a conference. That's not what it is about. My role is spotting something that's so interesting that others should know about it. That's my role. And that's what I have to bring in. And the form happens to be a conference or a seminar. And the last 2 years, amazingly, I've been busier than ever because there's new ways of connecting now. And people also in very small groups can share information with each other. So, it's an exciting time. Apart from that, of course, what I do is a form of trend spotting, looking at things and being excited about things. I honestly, of everything, I like this first phase the best. But right now we are in this, Web3 and NFTs and the metaverse. I like it the best because it's the moment where everybody thinks something's happening. And all the artists suddenly are in there. Maybe just that's the part that they think, if the artists get involved, then there's something on because they're always there very early on. And they look at what's this? What is? What can we do with this? Okay. And then they drop it again after a while. So then it turns out to be something completely different. But I like this first phase. And then, I'm 55 now. So I realize that actually, I can think every 3 years that I still have another career in the making somewhere, but I don't. This is it. So I might as well be very good at it and just do it with all my heart because this is what I ended up with. And again, because this is a career path question as well, I knew that I wanted to be in this new industry, which I feel is not the media industry. It's something else. It's this discovery that all humans across the world are connected via the same internet. And what does that mean? It means so much. And we still don't know. We're still somehow early phase. And so I knew that, but I started a company and the company went bankrupt after 5 years. So I made huge mistakes. It turns out I'm not a good entrepreneur. I can know everything about the internet, but that doesn't mean you can run a team and balance a budget. So I took all kinds of steps to find out what role fits me, but I kept with my initial interestedness in this intriguing thing. What does it mean that we are all connected? It means so much. It means e-commerce, it means blockchain, it means everything, democracy. It goes the whole gamut of things is now changed because this network is there.
Right. Following up on this, I mean, Monique, you're mentioning Web3, NFTs, and the metaverse. And every 2-3 years, something new comes along, despite our misgivings that we've seen it all.
Social media, second screen, Web2, everything, data.
Exactly. And there's some structures throughout it all, I think, as Taco mentioned and remind us of. And on the other hand, there's constantly some new stuff happening. And Tark, you were mentioning that, you know, responsibility of thinking about and overseeing and stimulating audiovisual storytelling. I want to focus on storytelling a little bit, because that is sort of at the heart of what media making is, for whether you're a journalist or a game developer or somebody, a creative in advertising, you want to tell stories. Yeah. Now, in terms of storytelling, you could argue that we've moved from an area where you could talk about a specific story for a specific medium, like television or like a print newspaper or whatever, to a digital environment where stories, I mean, we still have film and TV shows and newspapers online, but they also sort of bleed into each other. They converge. They constantly develop new approaches, new formats. There's new ways of telling stories where all elements of all these other stories come together. It's very exciting. And to some extent, also an uncharted path, I guess. So my question is, how do you stay on top of these kind of trends and developments? I mean, I guess you can spend 24 hours a day following all the tweets and all the magazines and all the blogs and all the newsletters and talking to all the people and still, you know, have this intense feeling of FOMO, of fear of missing out. Like, there must be someone somewhere that knows more about this. And on the other hand, you do want to focus on what works. I mean, I'm hearing that a little bit in your narrative too, Taco, because ultimately you have this station to manage, you have this company to, and maybe, you know, makers and artists, like you said, Monique, are changing and are exciting, but audiences maybe not. So I guess it's a similar question to my previous one. It's like, how do you, on the one hand, stay on top of this incredibly fast-moving industry and all the new opportunities, and the other hand, how do you keep focus on, you know, what works and what doesn't? I mean, how do you prevent yourself from sort of drowning in this sea of new developments?
Well, maybe I can go first. I mean, I'm a contributor to a newsletter by a guy who's 10 times cleverer than I am. He's called David Metten, and he writes New World, Same Humans. That's the newsletter. And so to come back to, humans are the same and they want the same things. They want connection, they want status, they want stories, and always try to, you know, figure out, okay, so if the technology changes, if the options in the network change, if the ways of connecting change, what does that mean for our, you know, initial human approaches? When it comes to storytelling, I'm definitely not the best one to ask, because at the beginning, I mean, I already wasn't watching TV that much. And at the beginning of the pandemic, I thought, I mean, and then TV, I mean, Netflix, everything. So all the visual stories that much. And at the beginning of the pandemic, I thought, like, what shall I do? And I stopped watching completely. So I don't watch anything. You know, my kids sometimes force me to say, Mom, we have to see this. But then I see, observe what people do. So I observe also the people around me. And for instance, for stories, shared stories are so strong. And weirdly enough, people in the TV space specifically used to think like, oh, you know, you need this moment when everybody watches something together at the same time, which we now only have with the Eurovision Song Festival finale or some big soccer game or something. But everybody, because then we have a shared story. And then I look at my kids and, you know, my daughter's 15 and there's a series she watches, and my son is 18, and she really wants to discuss the character development in that series with her brother, but he watches the same series at different moments. But because they can watch it anytime they like, they can both watch it. So there's a whole group, her whole group is watching the same series anytime they like, but they share it at the same time. And I think the sharing and discussing and understanding and making memes about it and doing your own TikTok version about it, and that's where the new magic happens. You know, there's a new space around the story, But the heart of the story, that series, is actually almost the same. It's not different in the format. It's just the communication space around the stories have changed.
Hmm.
Taco, what do you think?
Yeah, exactly.
I tend to agree with you. It's, you know, I've been, especially when I worked for public broadcasting, I've been experimenting with multimedia, cross-media, transmedia, to be to come to the conclusion that it was all a bit overrated, because you know, the last hit on Netflix is Squid Games, and you wanted to see episode 1 until 8 the quickest possible, and it's a story, and you want to see it from the beginning to the end. So that basically didn't change. And of course, in my industry, the major difference now is the coming of VOD. And I do not completely agree with you, Monique. Sorry for that. You see certain formats that do well on linear television because it's an event that you want to join. When we for IDTV, for instance, that was The Mole. The Mole is on Saturday evening, an event that you have to see on Saturday evening. The Masked Singer is also a very interesting example. You know, it's something that you watch on linear television. While Dating, for instance, is very strong on VOD. Fiction is very strong on VOD. So you see certain types of stories that work better on certain devices. And I think that's interesting for us because there's a lot of development also in the audience taste. We are still learning to see what functions best, what can we change. And you see that the broadcasters are experimenting with it. Maybe an interesting example is also last year we launched The Traitors with IDTV. It did very, very well on RTL4, amazingly well. And now together with celebrities. And we did in this last year, November, then a version with normal people for the VOD platform Videoland, so kind of spin-off. So you see, and actually you see the same thing here in Germany, in the US, everybody is experimenting. So interestingly enough, for instance, the Traitors, which is also becoming an international hit, which is of course great for IDTV, but we sold it to NBC in America, to Peacock, which is their VOD platform. While in Belgium, we sold it to the linear television station. So there's a lot going on, and the laws or the rules are not quite clear yet, which makes it a very interesting and fascinating period, I have to say. But to come back to the environment that you because I'm there, I strongly agree with you, with Monique, that there is a kind of environment and existing around the story that you tell. For us, in because we also have a commercial interest, of course, I tend to approach it with a linear from a linear perspective. Because what happens before the story starts is, of course, for us, marketing communication. It's how are we going to sell the story? And with the amount of content that you have, it's primordial that you do a good marketing action up front. Otherwise, the people just won't notice, however great your content is, that it's there. So that's for us a real, really important. And when it comes down to the environment, that's we call that ancillary. So for instance, for the Traitors, we're developing a card game, you know, these kinds of, it's still very hard to make money with social media, for instance, to find viable models. There we struggle, especially, I don't have to explain the whole advertisement model that's behind Facebook and other social media, the big social media that come from the US. So It is also there we're experimenting, and it's also funny to see that we thought sometimes ago, also maybe interesting to tell that, for instance, when YouTube became big, there were loads of TV producers who said, oh, finally, now I can broadcast my own stuff and it will be great. I will earn money that way. And of course, all production companies discovered that broadcasting doing it through the internet is something completely different from producing media, what we are specialists in. So
I think it just happens. I did an event yesterday about streaming media and then looking at lots of niche offerings that are there, and where, I mean, there's something interesting happening now that was announced many years ago, but it's now happening because broadband is everywhere. People have unlimited internet access also on the phones, the machinery, it all exists now. You can deliver very high quality video over the internet with no problems at all. And what you now see is lots of these places where groups of people get together and are willing to pay for it because it's exactly what they want. We had two guys yesterday. We had there's a guy who used to organize the Restaurant Week, of course, closed down because of the 2 years ago because of COVID. So we asked five chefs to film the making of a dish, five dishes. So they had 25 short movies about that. And they started Chefflix, which now is 20,000 people paying €5 per month to see movies of chefs doing dishes. There was also Eric de Zwart, which has an online channel with only train movies. So these very small communities suddenly can now find a viable business model, which 5 years ago you couldn't, because people weren't used to paying for things. And there were not enough people around, the quality wasn't good, people didn't know how to turn a video feed from the internet up on their big screen, which they like, or on their phone. There is a turning point, and one of the comparisons that was made yesterday was, think of before, when you went to the bookstore and there was a magazine rack with all kinds of super specialized interests. Those will all be video channels now. There will be communities around video that are small niche and that people simply pay for. So there is a change going on in that. That doesn't change storytelling. It changes the kind of thing you can share via video in the channel. I mean,
To make it a bit interesting, maybe, I don't agree at all.
Okay, good.
Now, from so what do you, if you look at the landscape and what we are, as television production companies, we're of course constantly scrutinizing the market and seeing what happens. So what do you see happening now? You see this, these streamers coming, the HBOs, the Netflix, and they order this very, very expensive fiction that comes from Hollywood mainly. Yeah? And sometimes you have, of course, they say, you have to create something locally and it can go global. You have a nice example, such as La Casa de Papel and so on. But it's, wow, it is really high-end fiction. And especially in the Netherlands, for instance, we have a hard time reaching that level. I think we, in the Netherlands, we don't have a very strong cinema tradition. Unfortunately, we have a government that doesn't stimulate art and creativity that much as they do in other countries. So we are not going to be able to play a role there. And on the other hand, you see people are watching less television. And now the local broadcasters have to move into VOD to compete with them. So why do you think that SBS and RTL announced that they will merge? The only reason for that is because they can't afford this content and expensive content they can't afford it. So they can't compete with Netflix, HBO Max, and Disney. So the problem, Monique, is that good content is expensive. So of course you will have some niche content and maybe something about trains or something. But if you want to to fill a proper VOD platform and you want to attract and continue to attract people, you have to the churn, as in, I recently learned. So you, it's very important people stay coming. And if you want to have them returning, you have to add new content all the time. And you have to add high quality content because you're competing in attention with the Netflix and HBO Maxes and so on. So, what you see now, this is an incredible challenge now for local broadcasters as RTL, but also here in Germany, you see the same happening to continue attracting audiences, national audiences on VOD platforms.
Hmm. Yeah, but I think I understand what you're saying and also where you're coming from, because I think the interesting thing, but that's because I think is what else is happening. That's interesting. And what else is happening is also that content can be super engaging and not being high quality fiction. I agree that the kind of high quality fiction is like the cathedrals of this age, you know, where hundreds of people work together to make something fantastic and every little detail thought out and it costs millions and millions to make. But strangely enough, there's really engaging content that's super cheap to make, and there's video communities existing out there that are not even thinking about this as making money, but they just want to make this stuff, you know. And you know, the growth of streaming is not so much in streaming, the fiction side of things. It's, the growth is in all kinds of lessons and fitness and educational stuff. And so there are other groups of people doing other things. Sorry, this is me.
Maybe I can piggyback a little bit on this discussion, then, because it's what to me this signifies is I mean, there are possibilities into two. Here now we have identified two major directions, right? High quality, professionally produced, engaging content, and not just like one show, two shows, but a continuing stream of engaging content. And on the other hand, all kinds of smaller or niche productions that may or may not be, you know, incredibly well funded or produced, but because it is a niche or it is a unique idea, or whatever, they can find a target audience as well. Yeah. Great. One of the interviews in this series was with a colleague and a good friend, Christian Allen, who represents Epic Games, the makers of Fortnite. And of course, what they also did, they released the Unreal Engine 5, which is a virtual production studio where now people from all over the world can make like incredibly amazing looking, high quality content. You see the Unreal videos already appearing on YouTube with millions of views using free downloadable software. So it's I mean, obviously, there's a lot of exciting stuff happening. I think we can agree on that. My question is, both of you are in positions where you talk to makers a lot, right? I mean, I'm assuming Taco, you one of the things that you're facing is people coming to pitch you new ideas or trying to tell you like, we're going to make this or we need to make that, or I want to tell this story. And Monique, you were just talking about that one of the ways in which you can get excited about a new development is by following the artists. The ultimate makers, and like when they get excited about something and start creating exhibitions and all kinds of stuff, there's something going on there. Now, how do you deal with makers? Because makers generally, and I'm not, you know, I'm not in any way, shape, or form judging that at all, but tend to only think of the story that they want to tell. It is, it's generally not that, I mean, like your perspective, Taco, which you said earlier, well, I take the position of the user or the consumer, or I'm also, I'm acknowledging that there's a role of marketing and data and all of this, as well as just getting excited about, you know, a new platform or format. But makers tend to, and understandably so, maybe necessarily so, are focused on this great idea that they have, this story, their little baby. How do you get them to embrace all these new opportunities to appreciate I love the term, Monique, that you said, the communication space around the story that they want to tell, or what you say, Taco, the auxiliary environment that they also need to fill in order to get people to pay attention to this great story idea that they have. I know from interviews in other fields that adds a lot of extra work, more labor, more responsibilities on top of what makers already are doing. And not everybody gets excited about that. So how do you see that? What's the role of makers here? Should they carry this weight as well? Can we expect them to balance, you know, the beauty of the story with the need to engage audiences around the story, or how do we handle expectations? This is a big sounds to me like a big issue today.
Well, my answer can be really short. I mean, I trust the makers. So the way that I interface with the makers is follow what they do. And if I think it's super interesting, get them on stage and let them tell their story. Mm-hmm. But I follow them because the makers will see something and grab something and make something out of it. And I trust that. So I don't. And I also think if somebody wants to make something that is completely unrelated to all the digital things in the world, then that's what they need to make. I mean, that's what they do. They should only do what they do best. So, but again, my role is not to find a business model for the makers. My role is just to find the makers that are super interesting and have them tell their story. So I have a very small, short answer there.
You're celebrating the makers. Great.
Yes, absolutely.
Taco, how do you deal with makers?
Well, we usually speak of talent.
Yes.
And because I'm in a creative industry, of course, and then everybody is talented now. It's the most important part of my job, Mark, because it's what do we have? I could walk around with my computer here and you see a few people sitting and some computers, and that's it. We don't have expensive machines. We don't have much, actually. We have talented people who come up with interesting stories. Mm. So the managing of talent is my most, I consider it to be my most important job, because that's how you can build a company in a competitive country like Germany and especially in the Netherlands, which is a very competitive market. You need to be able to have the best talent in your company. And now you will ask how do you do that, which is not
yes.
There's not an easy answer. I discovered
anti-conformist or
non-conformist.
Thanks, Monique. Yeah.
Thank you. We need you to help to get this part. So especially it's maybe also a cultural thing in the German market is very funny. So I had these two guys, very great talents, and we were signing, we were talking about the contract because of course you need something legal as well. And they said, yeah, what about the holidays? And I said, the holidays? Figure it out yourself. And I found that so funny because, you know, one of the things that I discovered that talented people, creative talented people need is freedom. So you, of course, you have to restrict it a little bit, but the more freedom you can grant them, the better, which is a country which is a bit more rule-driven than the Netherlands, for instance, Germany, that's really, for them, refreshing. Okay, hey, wow. Because I think that the only thing that talent wants and needs is an environment where they can do great things, where they can the best they can be, to quote Nike, it was, I believe. So be the best you can be. What do you need? You need an environment where you can excel. You need freedom. You need inspiration. So all the soft parts of the company, I'm very, very attentive to it. Mm. I had, maybe this will surprise you. So I'm responsible now for a company that's doing more than 100 million turnover. And this morning I was talking with my boss, who is 10 times as big, about the fact that in the company that I'm working in, they work with, how do you call it? You have to file your hours. You have to
write your hours like lawyers do. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I said, I want to get rid of it. So this maybe you think, well, this is a tiny thing. Why are you talking about this? Because I think it's crucial to build a creative environment. And if you ask people to, if you bother them with bureaucracy, they won't feel well, and they won't stay with you. So I'm constantly learning about it, because it's not easy to manage creative talents, because they can be obnoxious, arrogant, not realistic, etc. But they're big fun as well. And well, last time, Mark, we had an interesting discussion about someone I know and how you manage them. I think it's the most important thing if you're leading a creative company, to be able to offer them something that's attractive and it's not money.
Marco, can you please come and manage the university? I see parallels all
lots
over
of
the
bureaucracy.
Place. And you know, but I appreciate this very much, Taco, both of you, the way you talk about this and what you like, you know, supporting the makers and celebrating what they come up with and giving them as much freedom as possible and freedom from the shackles of bureaucracy. That's beautiful. That's lovely. Taco, I also appreciate your honesty in saying that sometimes talent can be obnoxious and stubborn or not seeing the limits of what is possible, either financially or creatively or technologically or whatever. Which leads me to the question about, you know, what kind of people can survive in this environment? One thing that has always struck me about these conversations that I have with media professionals is that, you know, everybody is committed to what they do. Everybody cares about what they do, the project that they're working on, the story that they want to tell. It's their little baby. Their passion work. The word passion is bandied about all the time, and that's lovely. And because of that passion, people also consistently want to get better at what they're doing. And at the same time, you're part of an industry that has constraints, that you deal with a lot of pressures, that is constantly changing. And it's not necessarily the best people that end up doing great work. I mean, it's often people that actually like working together, or like you said, Taco, are part of a company where it just feels good to do the work. That might not necessarily be the most talented people, but the most talented people might not be able to actually get the job done or get a product finished on deadline. So I guess in a long-winded way, my question is, do you see now, looking back and looking at the kind of people you've worked with, kind of person you are yourself, I mean, does it take a certain type of personality or a set of personality traits to be good at surviving in this media industry? Or is it really just a matter of a specific skill set? And I do think these things are very different. Skill set can be seen objectively, like you have to be good at Photoshop or, you know, those kind of things, or the graphic press, as you said, Monique. But personality is something else. I mean, of course, you can cultivate and train it and all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, that says a lot about who you are and knowing yourself. And I wonder what your take is on this. I mean, can you say something? Well, this is the kind of person that consistently sort of knows his or her way around this industry more perhaps than somebody else.
Well, I mean, I guess in a way we're talking about two industries, because my part of the industry is more internet people and entrepreneurs. And mm-hmm. I've had a lot of people on stage that I had to interview or that I invited to speak that are super, super successful. And they have all kinds of background skills. I mean, they have skills, no doubt about it, but they also have this, they're able to prioritize. And they very often really, you know, not necessarily the most fun people to be with, because they have a goal and they're very focused on that goal. But at the same time, what I find is that the trait that really makes them different and then begins gets interesting again is a basic curiosity. And it's a curiosity that is not just in their topic, but beyond their topic. Because things happen not within one set of ideas and practices, but when it crosses over to other areas. So the people that are interested in everything sometimes see connections that others don't. So I think a sort of a very basic curiosity into the world and not just into your own career or your line of work, but just, oh, that's interesting. Oh, I didn't know this happened like this. Oh, that feeling that seems to be widely shared among many of the people that I consider to be super successful. And then it might not be money successful, but successful, you know, moving on from one thing to the other. Yeah. So curiosity and a certain humbleness as well. I mean, I think people that surround themselves with people that are cleverer than or more creative or more efficient. I mean, I think a lot of the creative people are not very efficient, but if they are surrounded by other people who are very efficient, they can move forward together. So this idea that you realize my main skill is this and this, but I need other skills as well. And the media industry is definitely a team industry. You know, there's very, I mean, it can be, if you want to be completely alone, be a philosopher or an artist. But if you want to be in the media industry, you have to be able to work with teams. That means that you also have to completely appreciate anybody that does something different than you and really see that they are valuable as well to realize your creative project or whatever. So that this cooperation, I think, is essential to the media industry as well. And that's not something everybody is super good at.
Taco, do you recognize this curiosity about everything, being good and in not just working in a team, but feeling part of a team and appreciating?
There are some things I completely agree and some things that I don't agree. I will give you some, and of course it depends on the industry that you're in, but I will give you some examples as well. The most successful people in the television and media industry, in my opinion, is they have a unique combination of creativity and sales power. And they're creative. I don't have to explain, but they sense what is needed. They sense where the trend is. They have a Fingerspitzengefühl, to use a nice German word. So they are also, you know, when they Monique, when you put someone on stage, you have to sell a story. You have to get the attention of a buyer or of a company or whatever. So and this combination is rather rare. You don't see it very often. So you have very creative people that go in any direction, come up with ideas that you can never sell. And you have people that are very sales driven, but not creative. And if you, in the media industry, you need both, because the one who pitches is the one you sell from, or is the one who sells. The curiosity part, I strongly agree, and because that's nourishing creativity, and you need focus also. So these are I go along with Monique. Then she was talking about humbleness. Now, well, I can tell you the best creatives are not humble at all.
I was surprised by that too, to be honest. Yeah.
Let's take the man who twice completely changed the television landscape, John de Mol. Now, you can tell a lot about him, but he's not a humble person. We have in our group Stephen Lambert, who made incredible shows and is making worldwide formats again and again. I think the best known is Undercover Boss or Four in the Bed, Bed and Breakfast, it's called in the Netherlands. And there is an endless line of formats he developed. And I don't say, and he is not humble at all. I'm working within IDTV with Mark Pos. And Mark Pos, he founded his own company. He is not a humble person at all. And he will never say that he's a humble person either. So It's not something I recognize in the industry. And also what I find interesting is about the team effort. So of course you're very right when you say you need nowadays so many in media making. Of course, there's not, John de Mol doesn't decide on everything. He needs a good team and he works with the best people because, well, he pays a lot of money, but he gets good people. On the other hand, I have also, and this is also completely against what's fashionable in theory, is that we say that creativity is a group process. So I have been experimenting a lot with Google sprints and brainstorming forms, etc. And to discover that the best creatives, they utterly hate it. They don't work that way. So
I agree with that one completely. But the creative person needs other people to realize their dreams. So you have to be able to share what you want to create with a lot of other people that have to do and believe in what you want to establish and create to take them along on that ride. So
of course
it's a group process, and most of the people in this audience will be part of that group, you know. No, there will be one or two in this group that will change the media industry, but most of them will find a space in those changes somewhere in those teams.
No, but yeah. Of course, I mean, it's one of my roles also is to, when one of our creators comes up with ideas, to critically ask questions and come up with ideas. And sometimes I am able to even make his idea a bit better. But what I mean more, and I talk about it because it's very fashionable at this moment, to say creativity is a group effort, and that's when you get the most creative ideas, etc. And all companies were experimenting with Google spins, and I've tried it all. So it's not that I say, well, I don't think it works. No, I've tried it, and then. Well, let's say one of the creatives said to me, and many good creatives, they don't, first of all, they don't want to participate. So they don't feel inspired by this.
And what about, because, you know, if you look at all the American series and comedy shows, they usually have teams of writers, right? It is definitely a group process. It wouldn't be possible to generate so many scripts and so many storylines and so many developments by one person alone. So it seems to be a form of creativity that is shared in a group.
I completely agree. And the interesting thing also is, because I was just talking about personality. So writers' room in the Netherlands don't function. We don't have any writers' rooms. And that is because and in Germany neither. And I think that's because we still have also, it's also the environment, but it's also the personality. So in the Netherlands, the humbleness that you talked about is not present. Yeah. Maybe it's in the US. I know it's a system that functions over there, but in Europe, you hardly see it.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
But it is interesting, if I may, I think we need to go towards a conclusion, because I'm already taking up way too much of your time. But what I find really interesting is that in what you're telling us is that on the one hand, you can look at the media industry and using very sort of generic things about, you know, that we used to have analog media, now we have digital media, and we used to focus on this, and now we focus on data, or we, you know, big trends, big picture, and sort of global phenomenon, like the internet. But a lot of what I'm hearing you saying is actually really small and specific, dependent on a certain type of person or a certain group of people, the culture of a country, or even the culture of a specific company. Like things that you can only do within IDTV and not copy paste onto another company, just like that, like easy, you know, because it's all television. No, there's apparently a specificity about working with specific people in a specific cultural context, in a specific technological environment, like something you can do on television here, you can't do on VOD there or whatever. And I find that truly fascinating. And I think it speaks to this notion of being constantly curious, because you know, one thing both of you have learned, you can't just copy paste what you've done before onto another or new environment. Is that too? Yeah, Monique, I guess that's what I'm asking. Yeah, is that true or not?
I think these media cultures that you describe previously could only exist in a company or a country, but now there's also cultures developing that, because of the internet, are spread out across the world, but nevertheless very strong media cultures. I mean, and it can be seen in the way TikTok movies are copied and shared. And I mean, it's a media culture. It may not be a big company VOD series of 9 years episodes or something, but it's media culture in which people thrive, in which they are creative, in which they are, you know, gain audiences, in which they develop themselves, in which they develop new formats. So these media cultures now can also exist elsewhere. And as a result, you suddenly have millions of media cultures. It's not just, you know, right, a few big companies.
So, but you can't just copy what works on TikTok onto YouTube, or Twitch, then it goes horribly wrong, right? Yeah.
And there's always a crowd that goes for the new thing and, you know, leave your parents behind on Facebook and we'll go elsewhere and things like that. But it's media cultures that, and these are as strong and as engaging as the best Netflix series. You know, people are in there for hours as a media culture, and not only consuming but also creating. So I think that's a change as well. So it's not so location and company focused anymore. Or it still is, but there's also something else.
Taco, how does that work for you?
Now, with the risk to becoming too philosophical, I'm thinking also of the difference, you know, between a social reality and a physical reality. Mm. You know that in social reality, things are not as easy, are not as linear as you might expect them to be in a physical world. And I think we started this session also by talking about curiosity. And I think the combination of curiosity and also being prepared to not to stick too much to your opinion, that's so vital. And and of course, curiosity is that. So to give you an example of what just happened is for me, how it works with me, because that's the only thing I could talk about, is that Monique just talked about these writer rooms. And now I'm, you know, now it's in my head. Okay, so how is it bloody possible that you can have successful writer rooms in the US, and why doesn't it work in the Netherlands or Germany? And what can we do to make it work? Can we do something to make it work? And what's happening there? And this is, you know, this curiosity of asking questions, finding things out, the subtleties that you talked about, you know. So, of course, when I said to earlier on, I don't agree with Monique, it is very well possible that in her world and in where you were working, these are, it works, it functions, it's, and while in the TV industry, it doesn't work at all. So you need to be, getting back to philosophy, the pragmatist truth, you know, pragmatic truth helps me a lot to develop and to, and it's also much fun, you know, that we don't have these strict laws of what functions and what doesn't. And the fact that we as producers are not the only one, but our clients, the broadcasters, the VOD platforms, the people in Los Angeles, they don't know it either exactly. And that is, for some people it's scary. And I think that another very important characteristic that you have to have is that you shouldn't be afraid.
Afraid?
Yeah, don't be afraid.
Oh, don't be afraid, sorry.
Don't be afraid.
You see, we're really opposite. I would say, yeah, you have to be afraid because you never know what's going to happen. That's why he runs a multi-million company and I sit here in Deep North on my freelancing away. Yeah. You know, I wouldn't dare ever to run such big projects. No, there you go.
But risk-taking, doing something that's going somewhere where no one has gone before, that's part of entrepreneurship and creativity and development and everything, at least, I'm into.
I think that's a beautiful conclusion to be drawn, final statement. Dear Monique Taco, thank you so much for your time, for your openness, for your curiosity. I look forward to when we meet again and can continue the conversation and see you at the next big event, Monique and Taco. Hope to catch you around, perhaps as a speaker at one of Monique's events. You always That's have it. Such great stories to tell.
Okay, thank you
take
so
care.
Much.
Thanks so
thank
much.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.